This is John Granrose, Magical Archetypes, October 13th, the year 2000.
He has his own way of expressing what he feels around the archetypal structures, and being from a long family tradition, really also a very accomplished magician. And looking at the magical and that what grows out of our unconscious in an unknown, unrational way, that's really what our Jungian journey largely is about. And I think nobody is more qualified than John Granrose, who at the present also is the director of studies of the C.G. Jung Institute in Zurich, which is a very important position to hold in this outer world. So without further ado, I want my friend John Granrose to come and talk to us about the archetype of the magician. I want to thank Peter Elting for initiating this, and also the officers of the Jung Society here in Seattle for making it possible. I've been looking forward to it for the last year or so. It's the first time I've been in Seattle, and I'm looking forward to my weekend. I'll say something about the slide that's on the wall at the moment. I'm going to be talking about magic and archetypes, but my talk is based on the diploma thesis that I wrote at the Jung Institute in 1996, called The Archetype of the Magician. So far as I know, it's the only diploma thesis that's available on the internet. It has jumped around from different websites from one to the other. Currently, it's available on the website granrose.com. Everyone is dot-comming themselves. And the last time I flew from the United States to Zurich, I saw in the airline magazine that some web hosting service was offering websites for $7.95 a month. And I said to one of my friends in Zurich, that's so inexpensive, I could do that just for fun. He happens to run a web hosting service himself, and he said he could do it for even less. So that's how I happen to have a website. It's really under construction, but the entire text of this thesis is there. And that's worth knowing because it helps me relax tonight. I don't have to cover everything. I know Seattle is very wired, and everybody can access this, and if it interests you, you can print it out and read it. So I'm not going to feel pressured to cover everything that's in my research. Before I change the slide, I'll tell you a story about how I became a Jungian analyst. I was a philosophy professor for many years. And in the 1970s and 80s, I started getting more and more interested in Jung. I was living in Georgia, teaching at the University of Georgia. And in Atlanta, there was the Atlanta C.G. Jung Society. And in Birmingham, Alabama, there was Friends of Jung South, a very old Jung Society. I used to go to these meetings. And eventually, I entered into analysis. And at one of the meetings, I was talking to an analyst. And I said, you know, sometimes I have the fantasy of going to Zurich and training to be an analyst. The person I was talking with was Bonnie Shorter of Edinburgh, Scotland. And she said, well, why don't you do that? I mean, what's stopping you? And I said, I don't know the address. Now, obviously, that was some kind of complex because I could easily have found out the address. But ever since, when I give a talk to some public group where I think there might be someone in the audience who has the same fantasy, I always show the address of the Jung Institute. Hornweg 28 in Küsnacht. So no one has that excuse that I had for so many years. Also, when I first went to Zurich, the Institute had never had a fax machine. And, of course, they didn't have email or anything like that. And I said, well, why don't we have a fax machine? And the answer was, we've never had one before. And that's been the story of my life in Zurich, as a student and now as the director of studies. Don't get me started on that. After the meeting's over, we can talk about gossip about the Jung Institute of Zurich or whatever. In outline form, this is what I'd like to try to cover in about an hour, 50 to 60 minutes, something like that. I see it's just about quarter till now, so I'll try to stop in 50 minutes, let's say. And then we'll have a little break, and then we'll have some questions after that. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. I'll give you a little bit of introduction to the topic, how I got interested in it, and something about the background. Then I'll say a little bit about archetype. The topic for tonight has been variously listed as magic and archetypes, or the archetype of the magician. And so to talk about the concept of archetype is the starting point. We won't do that for very long because one could spend the whole winter talking about that concept, or there are many books written about it. But I'll give you a little introduction. Then we'll talk about some aspects of the concept of magician, mana personality, shaman, trickster, to some extent fool. Then we'll talk about four magicians, two mythological or fictional, so to speak, Hermes and the magician card in the tarot, and one who's clearly historical, Harry Houdini, and one who is probably partly historical, Merlin. Probably there was a historical Merlin or two that got elaborated on in these stories. We'll talk a little bit about one other aspect of magic and magicians. We'll talk about magic words, and to some extent about the symbols such as the magic wand, but that will be a very minor part. And then I'll close by talking about ways in which the experience of analysis shares some of the characteristics of magic, and the analyst shares some of the characteristics of magician. So that's where we're going, okay, in the next 50 minutes. Jung wrote over 50 years ago, "Magic as practiced in the Middle Ages and harking back to much remoter times has by no means died out, but still flourishes today as rampantly as it did centuries ago." When I was teaching at the university, I used to often comment to my students that that I was not on television and I could see them and hear them, and they could talk back to me and make comments. It wasn't just a one-way street. And with that in mind, I wonder if you believe what Jung said, that magic as practiced in the Middle Ages is still with us as rampantly as ever. Do you think that that's true? Can you think of any example? Anything come to mind for you? Harry Potter stories, yes. Yes, Jung didn't have that in mind when he wrote this in volume 18. But yes, the popularity of the Harry Potter books, remarkable. What else? Well, there's a lot of magical thinking going on. A lot of people are very superstitious about one thing or another, and they think that if they do this, they will get some results, or good for good or ill. What other kinds of things come to mind for you? Yeah. Yes. Yes, and what do you mean by that? The magic of transformation, and what kinds of things come to mind for you? Yes, and we naturally use those words. It was magical. Some enchanted evening. Perfumes often have the word magic in their title. Advertising, television commercials often use words like wonder, enchantment, magical, bewitching. These kinds of concepts are in our vocabulary. The miracle of birth, but also transformation in cooking, you know, baking bread and seeing it, it's quite different when it comes out of the oven. Or the transformation of the caterpillar to the butterfly. You probably remember, I'm old enough now that in the 60s I had all sorts of posters on my wall that I still remember, and you don't see these kinds of posters much anymore, but I remember having a poster that showed a butterfly emerging from the cocoon, and it said, "You can fly, but that cocoon has to go." So transformation of all kinds. Do you have anything else that comes to mind for you? Yeah. Yes? Do some particular media that come to mind? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, the other, it's also a kind of medium, and can be magical. In some ways more magical when you use your imagination. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Yes? Yes, yes. I don't know if there are any website building software things that have magic in the title. Peter and I bought Dreamweaver the other day. And there may be, I'm familiar with FrontPage, but there might be another website builder that says magic something. I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah. Hmm? What? Pardon me? Uh-huh, okay. Uh-huh. Yes. Well, it's to reduce the magical thinking in the sense of omnipotent thinking and that type of thing. But if, Donald Kalshed, Donald Kalshed from New York, says the purpose of psychotherapy or Jungian analysis is to replace bewitchment with enchantment. You see, if you're bewitched, you're in the grip of a kind of bad magic. But to be enchanted, what's Thomas More's book, The Reenchantment of Everyday Life? That's a valuable thing. Yeah, even though magical thinking in the sense of omnipotent thinking is to be gotten rid of, probably. Yes. Yes, yes, thank you. That's exactly right. Some years ago, people were talking about their inner child and their inner whatever, and my friend Carol Pearson, in one of her books on archetypes, says that somewhere along the line, the inner magician is awakened. And what that means is something inside you that has a transformative power that can make obstacles disappear to some extent, or help you over them, or help unify the opposites, or whatever. So the concept of the inner magician is, in some circles, still popular today. Anything else you want to say about this magic is alive? Yeah. Yes. 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 A kind of literalization of magic. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Get control of your life by performing magic so that you will get a lover or a raise or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes. A couple in three I see back there. Mm-hmm. Yes, they do to me too. Yeah. Jung's concept of synchronicity is probably currently one of his most popular concepts. I mean, some years ago it was introversion, extroversion, and I suppose originally the notion of the complex was the central concept. But in our culture today, synchronicity is one of the key things. I'll start with that in just a minute as my first example. And there were three more people I see in the back. In the back row there were two, and then you're next. Yes? Yes? Yeah, we're looking for magic potions, magic solutions, magic some way to fix everything up, as if by magic. Yeah. And you had something. Yes? Yes? Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of physical processes that seem magical. Usually magic means something that is at least extraordinary, and to someone who doesn't daily work with photographic development or with the media, these things can really seem like magic. Yeah, and you had something up here. And you're thinking especially connected with advertising. Is that right or not? Yes? Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. One more comment. I saw a couple more hands, but then let's move on. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of magic in the arts, in the fine arts, in the performing arts, but not just in the fine arts, also in the crafts, making a clay pot, or doing something. Cooking is an art form that is often underrated, but the fine arts and the performing arts, yes, definitely come to mind. Synchronicity was mentioned. I'm not going to cover everything up here, but since we're just getting started, let me say something about the cave paintings in France. The cave of Les Trois Frères in Lascaux features the oldest image, which is usually called the Sorcerer, and is usually interpreted as a kind of hunting magic. It shows something like a shaman dressed up in a deer skin with antlers, probably trying to influence the hunt. So magic goes back to prehistory, not just to the ancient Greeks and Romans. Peter mentioned that magic was a tradition in my family, so I want to say something about that under the heading of learning from one's father. When I was a very small child, my father would pull quarters out of my ear, and I was quite impressed. Because I thought he really had that power, and when my little friends would come over, I would ask him to demonstrate that for them, and we were all impressed. We thought the other fathers couldn't do this, but he could pull quarters out of anyone's ear. And just to impress us with this feat, he always gave them to us. So that's one of my earliest memories. Then he showed me that it was all sleight of hand. And at first I was disappointed, and then I realized that I could enchant or entertain other people through this kind of hobby. So I learned it from my father, who was a member of the International Brotherhood of Magicians. And when I became about 12 years old, I started going to club meetings with him, and we started doing magic shows together. I still have some of the announcements. Dad and Johnny Granrose and their original magic show. So it is a family tradition. But that's not why I decided to pursue this. When I first was studying in Zurich, I had the concept that I would write a diploma thesis on something that I knew about academically. And as Peter mentioned, ethics was my main subject field in philosophy. And I thought I would write on ethics and analytical psychology. Probably most of you have had experiences like this. When you try to do something that's not quite right, you just can't do it. It just doesn't seem to have any energy. You just can't get going, like writer's block or something. I just couldn't get anywhere with this academic topic. And then one day I thought, well, maybe I could write on magic or magicians or something. That seemed to be related. Jung talks quite a bit about magicians. I also got to know Aniela Jaffe, Jung's former secretary, before she died in 1990. I often did some magic tricks for Frau Jaffe, which she liked, and she said, oh, Jung would have really liked that. He loved magic tricks. Somewhere Jung talks about the psyche and its box of conjuring tricks. So there is a lot of connection with Jung and magic. I won't bore you with lots of quotes. As we go through, there'll be a few quotes. Here's the synchronistic experience that starts us out tonight. I guess it's obvious. Some of you are analysts, and some of you know about the training process. After some semesters of more or less academic work, one begins to work with clients or analysands under supervision. So for the last 2.5 years that I was studying in Zurich, I was working with a group of clients. None of them knew that magic was my hobby, because long ago Peter convinced me that abstinence was a good rule in analysis, and I just didn't talk much about myself. So none of them knew this. I decided to turn in my thesis proposal on magic and archetypes, or the archetype of the magician, with a little bit of anxiety, because one of our good friends, Howard Tyus, had turned in a thesis proposal on archetypes in baseball. And the director of studies at that time turned it down and said this would bring the institute into disrepute. She wouldn't approve this. It would make us the laughing stock of the Jungian world. So Howard carefully rethought his proposal and decided to write on archetypal aspects of ball games, with baseball as his example, and that was okay. So this had just happened a few months before I was ready to submit my proposal. So I turned in the archetype of the magician and a little outline, and I was kind of concerned that it might be turned down. And while I was waiting to hear, one of my analysands had a dream. We worked in German, so I translated the dream into English, and I got her permission to share it with you, and I use it in the thesis. It's the only client material in the thesis and the only client material in the lecture tonight. Although I will give some other examples from analysis, but they're out of my own analysis, and you'll see just how crazy I am, or was. I won't read the entire dream, but it starts out, I have been visiting a theater in a medieval city. I was quite pleased when she had this dream. I thought this sounded like the kind of dream a Jungian, a client, ought to be having. Suddenly I notice that I am barefoot. Then I am in a hotel room, and I am looking for my shoes, but I don't find them. I ask the owner of the hotel. It is David Copperfield, the magician. He crawls under my bed and brings out a pair of shoes. At first, they don't seem to be mine, but later I realize that they are actually mine after all. That's the text of the dream. Naturally, as a good analyst in training, I said, what comes to mind for you with this dream? What are your associations or thoughts about the dream? And right away, she said, I need someone to help me get my footing. And the magician, that's you. You're the David Copperfield, and you can help. Now, there are two ways to look at dreams. Sometimes the figures in the dreams are inner figures. That's the subjective approach. And sometimes they are outer figures. And in this case, she was absolutely convinced that I was the magician in the dream and that somehow I could help her to go on in life, to find her right shoes, even though at first she wasn't convinced that this was really these were the right shoes. But she realized finally that was what they were. They were her shoes, and now they were found. The fact that she had this dream within 2 or 3 days of my turning in my proposal for this thesis on magicians, I took to be a synchronistic confirmation. As I was finishing the thesis, I had another experience that I'll tell you about at the end that I took to be another kind of synchronistic confirmation. Jung says that archetypes are active, living dispositions, ideas in the Platonic sense that preform and continually influence our thought and feelings and actions. They are inherited possibilities of ideas. If we were going to spend more time on this aspect of the talk tonight, I would explain more about Plato's theory of ideas. But I won't do that. It's in the thesis, and any philosophy course has probably talked about Plato and his theory of forms or ideas. The thing that Jung says that I want to emphasize is that archetypes are the inherited possibilities of ideas rather than inherited ideas as such. They are the background patterns, so to speak. We fill them in. There's, let's say, a pattern of parenthood or motherhood, fatherhood. We fill in our ideas of mother in special ways depending on our culture. We have the concept of, say, the Italian mother or the Jewish mother, or right? We have a specific kind of instantiation of the archetype that we call an archetypal image. Or we could say, in a development of this, that the symbols that we have in life, the symbols, whether of magic or success or relationship or whatever, have an archetypal basis or an archetypal root that is elaborated on in the culture. The last quote is the one I want to call your attention to. It's from Nikolai Tolstoy. I'm not sure, is he the grandson of Leo Tolstoy? I think it's the grandson or the great-grandson. Centuries come and go, literary fashions pass, but the magician reappears before us, shifting his shape, changing his name, now mocking, now awe-inspiring, but essentially the same character whose fame flew all over Europe 8 centuries ago. Trickster, illusionist, philosopher, sorcerer, he represents an archetype to which the race turns for guidance and protection. Now that's the starting point for what I want to deal with tonight. I think there is an archetypal basis, not just for stage magicians like David Copperfield, but for all of the ways in which we use terms like magic in our life. In the workshop tomorrow, we're going to be taking a practical approach to this. Tonight it's sort of theoretical. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about specific ways of finding more magic in life, or getting in touch with our inner magician, or making use of some of this material. The Persian magi, I would like to say something about. That's the three wise men or the three kings who come on Epiphany. The English word magic is based on the term magi, which referred to the priests of the Zoroastrian religion, who were a combination of astrologers, astronomers, scientists, engineers, historians. But because they were so educated, they had the power to foretell things. They had the power to help people heal. They had powers that in their time were deemed extraordinary or supernatural. And that's the origin of the term magic or magician. The mana personality is maybe the starting point from the Jungian standpoint. Mana is the Polynesian word for a kind of power. I think the best translation in English is charisma. Some personalities, tribal chiefs and such, rock stars, some people have charisma. And the magician is an example of one type of mana personality. Jung, I won't bore you with the quotations from Jung, but Jung says exactly that. Medicine man, magician, priest, tribal chief, these are all examples of mana personality. Shamanism is a topic that has been very popular in the United States in the last two decades or so. There are courses on shamanism, workshops. When I was down this past week visiting Peter in San Francisco, just yesterday I saw in the newspaper an advertisement for a Jungian shamanistic group. Wasn't led by an analyst, but it was to be a Jungian shamanistic group to train people in the techniques of shamanism. The shamanism as a religious phenomenon has to do with persons who have experienced the multiple levels of reality. They've experienced what we might call the overworld and the underworld, and they've traveled back and forth somehow on the pole of life. And they have brought us some kind of boon or some kind of message from one place or the other. And because they're experienced travelers in the other worlds, they're experts at soul retrieval. So if someone has lost his or her soul, they can go on a hunt and bring that soul back again. In a way, that's what people do. That's what we do in analysis, I think. We've lost our way. We've sort of lost our soul. And the analyst can't bring it back for us, but because the analyst has some experience with these things, the analyst can help us out. That's one of the things about studying in Zurich that seems to me to be very valuable. Foreigners like most of us here who have studied in Zurich go to Zurich and are, in comparison to the Swiss students, rather lost. And also in comparison to the Swiss students, most of whom, at the Institute currently we have 300 students, 100 of them are Swiss, and 200 are foreigners. Of the foreigners, most of them study in English. The Swiss study mostly in German, although there are a few French-speaking Swiss who study in the English language program. But in any case, the Swiss have work permits, and they are able to support themselves by working. So perhaps they cut back. They cut back on their medical practice or their therapy practice or their church activities or whatever it is they do to earn money, but they're still involved in their professional life. And typically, they're married, so they have a family. Most of the Americans who go, or most of the foreigners who go to Zurich to study, go alone, without family, and they are not able to get work permits. And so most of the foreign students at the Institute go through something like a night-sea journey or a dark night of the soul or a visit to the underworld just because they are so isolated. And in my experience, that's very good. That's a little bit like the shamanistic initiation, which involves a kind of creative illness, coming back, and then being able to help the tribe. Marie Louise von Franz has an interesting quote. I'll read it to you and I'll say why I find it interesting. The figure of the shaman is characterized by individual experience of the world of spirits, which today we call the unconscious. You see, von Franz says there's a mapping of the concept of spirits onto the concept of unconscious. And insofar as a shaman or a magician or an analyst comes to know the world of spirits, that's another way of talking about the unconscious. The last term that I want to call attention to is trickster. People often talk about stage magicians as doing magic tricks. All the magicians I know disdain that term. They don't want to be thought of as doing tricks. They think of themselves as doing illusions or performance pieces or miracles or something. Tricks is a demeaning kind of term. But nevertheless, the term trickster is very popular in Jungian circles. Coyote in Native American stories is a trickster figure. Paul Radin wrote a famous book, The Trickster, for which Jung wrote a contribution. Jung says, the trickster is a collective shadow figure, a summation of all the inferior traits of character in individuals. Now, tricksters are shadow figures, but remember, Jung says the shadow is 90% pure gold. So in the trickster energy, there is something very creative and powerful. I'll tell you a silly story that comes to mind for me. The first slide I showed you had the address of the Institute and the telephone and fax number, and also the Jung Institute's website, www.jung.edu. When I went to the Institute 2 years ago to become director of studies, the Jung Institute website was www.web80.eunet.jung-edu. Institute, without the E, the German spelling, .ch. And I used to say to colleagues, I'll give you 20 Swiss francs if you can repeat the URL for the Jung Institute. And I still have the 20 francs. So one of my contributions was to for the German speakers to reserve the domain name jung-institute.ch, ch standing for Switzerland, and German speakers are familiar with that kind of abbreviation. But to get the new domain name, jung.edu, for the institute, has the advantage that the EDU domain names are free. You pay it for the hosting, but the domain name is free for nonprofit educational institutions. So I reserved this domain name and with some enthusiasm, explained to the president of the institute, Dr. Spielmann, that we had this new domain name, and she was outraged. She said, we are not an American institution. And EDU is the way American schools end their domain names, and that won't do. Sort of, roughly, she said that. I'm not exaggerating either. Suddenly, my trickster energy arose, and I said, oh no, EDU comes from the Latin, educare, not from the English. Oh, she said, well, then that's fine. Now, that goes back to what was said here about transformation, because by this tricksterish quality, I was able to transform the situation, to reframe the situation, so that now everything is fine. EDU, perfect. But still, every time I see a Japanese or a Brazilian or a Swedish institution that ends in EDU, I call her attention to it so that she doesn't think it's just Harvard and Yale and Berkeley and such that end like that. That's an example of trickster energy. The first quote here I mentioned already. The man of personality is a dominant or an aspect of the collective unconscious in the form of hero, chief, magician, medicine man, saint, ruler, or friend of God. The concept of friend of God is interesting to me because actually the magical impulse or the seeing the world in magical terms I think of as part of what we could call the magico-religious impulse in people. I think we have a natural affinity for what Jung and Rudolf Otto called the numinous. And magic, whether it's David Copperfield shows, or whether it's ritual magic, or ceremonial magic, or magic in popular culture, these are numinous kinds of things that are related to the religious impulse. The difference between the priest and the magician in most anthropological accounts is that the priest sees himself or herself in the service of some higher power and is performing whatever is being done with the help of that higher power, whereas the magician, archetypally speaking, is someone whom the powers obey, someone who has discovered some kind of secret and the powers can obey him or her. That's the sense in which, because Jesus was such a special figure, Jesus was not just a priest like your priest in the neighborhood church. And there is a famous book called Jesus the Magician, because the winds and the waves, etc., obeyed him. A long story, and I won't elaborate on these things. The fool. I forgot to mention the fool. The fool is outside the normal social order. As the fool in King Lear is able to talk back to the king, magician figures of all sorts are also outside the social order in a way that can help us get some perspective on things. I'll give you some examples of this later on tonight and also in the workshop tomorrow. I hope some of you will come to the workshop. I've been on a little tour around the States for the last few weeks, and I've done this workshop in several different places, and I must say that each time the people in the workshop say they have learned something, but each time I have learned a great deal from the people in the group, and I'm looking forward to that tomorrow. Briefly, Hermes is probably the magician figure who is most discussed in Jung societies. Murray Stein went around the country a few years ago talking about his book In Midlife, which is basically stories about Hermes. Spring and the Journal of analytical psychology and Quadrant and Harvest and all of the Jungian journals from time to time have articles on the magician Hermes. Hermes or his Roman counterpart Mercury. On the seal of the International Brotherhood of Magicians is the figure of Hermes. Hermes is the god of magicians. He's also the god of thieves. Magicians are deceivers. Whether the magicians are stage magicians, conjurers, sleight-of-hand artists, or ritual magicians, or shaman, one of the things that I didn't realize until recently, till I was doing this research, one of the things that shaman or shamans traditionally do is to escape from bonds. They let themselves be tied up, and then either they escape, or, as in the old spiritualist seances, things happen while they are tied up. So presumably they know how to escape in the dark or how to escape and then retie themselves or something. But this whole idea of escaping is a traditional shamanistic performance. The quote from Jung, Hermes is a magician and god of magicians. The most famous story of Hermes, I suppose, is when he was born, he stole the cattle of Apollo. He did this on the day of his birth. He drove the cattle backwards, and he wore his own sandals backwards so that the footprints that were left would deceive his brother, Apollo. When Apollo came to Hermes' cave and accused him of stealing his cattle, Hermes said, cattle? What are cattle? I was just born. I don't know anything. I just stay here in my diapers and drink mother's milk. Apollo eventually proved that Hermes had stolen the cattle and confronted him again, and then Hermes confessed, and they made peace. Hermes, by giving Apollo the lyre, which he had made himself by killing, sacrificing a tortoise and stringing tortoise innards across the empty shell, and Apollo in turn gave Hermes his golden staff. I'll show you these on the screen in just a minute, but during the break, if you want to take a closer look, if you're not familiar with these images, they're back there. Oh, I forgot I had one slide of Hermes. This is not too easy to discern, I'm afraid, in this slide. But here you see Hermes' magic wand with the two snakes intertwining, the caduceus. The symbol for medical healing as well. So we'll talk about the magic wand imagery in a few minutes. Here's the first magician. Le batteleur in French means roughly the juggler. Sometimes the card is called the conjurer. In German, it's sometimes called der Gaukler. In England, it's sometimes called the mountebank. So this card, which is presumably the oldest magician, the oldest deck of tarot cards, the Marseille deck from the 14th or 15th century, although many people think the idea of tarot goes back much earlier, but the earliest complete major arcana or 22 symbol cards come from this Marseille deck. Take a look at this. This is something like the examination in picture interpretation at the Jung Institute, which people have to do before they graduate. We see immediately that the magician in some way has to do with opposites. The sides of his clothing are different colors. His shoes are different colors. But somehow the opposites are connected or unified. They're all sewn together and they all make up, just as in the Harlequin costume with the black-white. It suggests that the magician has to do with the overcoming of opposites or something like the union of opposites. The magician holds a symbol of his authority in one hand, his magic wand. The wand is golden. In this kind of symbol system, the golden stands for something like divine. So the magician's power is a kind of divine power. But then when you look at what the magician has on his table, in contrast to almost all of the more recent tarot cards, the magician has the traditional equipment of the sleight-of-hand artist or the conjurer. He has the cups and the balls, And in the workshop tomorrow, as I think it said in the publicity, I'm going to be explaining a couple of magic tricks and teaching at least one. And the one I'm going to be teaching you is the cups and balls trick. I can do this by special dispensation from the International Brotherhood of Magicians, because certain magic tricks have been, declared to be in the public domain. So, for instance, the author of Magic for Dummies, which I also recommend to you, is a member of the International Brotherhood of Magicians. The tricks taught in Magic for Dummies are very fine magic tricks, but they're, so to speak, in the public domain and not subject to the secrecy which protects most magic tricks. So in the workshop, I'll be talking more about that. I assume that the magician has a coin in his hand. I think he's doing some kind of sleight of hand with this gold coin. He stands on uneven ground. The number of the magician card is 1. He's beardless. He seems to be a young person starting out on this pilgrimage. The later cards, the emperor and such, are men with beards. And in some of the other cards, it's a long story. I'm not going to spend all night on the magician. I'll show you this painting by Hieronymus Bosch from the 15th century of a magician doing the cups and balls trick. I noticed just now that I've reversed it. If you're familiar with the painting, it's left to right. I'm sorry about that. Since there are no words, only people who know the painting recognize that. But one of the interesting things about this painting, besides the cups and balls, is the pickpocket. He's taking advantage, as we'll see in the workshop tomorrow, of the classic principle of magic, misdirection. And so his victim is so entranced by what's going on in the magic show, and of course he's trying to misdirect people by looking anywhere other than down, probably shows his bad conscience or something. But nevertheless, he's performing a kind of sleight of hand. The most famous tarot magician is from the Rider-Waite deck, and that's the most popular tarot deck, although it's not so old. It was done in 1909. But you notice, in contrast to the tarot magician from the Marseille deck, who really is a street entertainer, this magician seems much more like a priest. Based on his robes, and I'll go back two slides. The hat I didn't talk about. The hat is usually a symbol of office, the conductor's hat, the policeman's hat, the military officer's hat. And in this case, the magician's hat is something like the lemniscate, the figure eight on its side, symbol of infinity, which occurs, in this case, above the magician's head. In this tarot card, the figure eight is something like the caduceus, the intertwined snakes. This card is interesting for a number of reasons. Are you familiar with this? This comes from a deck called the Jungian Tarot. The only thing that makes it Jungian, I wish that I could say it was done by a Jungian analyst somewhere, but it wasn't. It was done by a Jungian-oriented psychotherapist or artist or something somewhere, fairly recently. But on the back of the cards, instead of just having a plain design like a crosshatch pattern on which most of the decks have, it has a lot of Jungian symbolism and Jungian quotations, vocatus, aqua, non vocatus, things like that. It's quite interesting in its own right. This magician is also a bit like a priest. As with the other magicians, he has one hand raised. This is the most dramatic. And he's saying in the Hermetic tradition, as above, so below. Or, as one says in the Christian tradition, on earth as it is in heaven. It's the same kind of notion as in the Hermetic tradition. As above, so shall it be below. On the table for this magician are the implements of alchemy rather than of conjuring, and rather than the four suits of the tarot, which the Rider-Waite magician has, the pentacles, the swords, cups, and such. And on the table is the most interesting feature, and I'm unsure whether it's a fly, you see, as in fly in the ointment, or
let's get real here. You know, the natural world intrudes into the ceremonial world of the magician. Or whether it might be a bee. The bee has a lot of symbolism, is a very powerful symbol, and I can't tell by looking at this. The bee, of course, can transform the nectar from the flowers into honey. So the bee is a traditional symbol of transformation. Another more obscure tarot deck, but to illustrate again the magician's connection with infinity, as shown in the infinity sign, the traditional symbols of the tarot on the table, but in this case, one of the rare magicians who has a beard, like I do. Now we'll talk about Merlin. I suppose of all the images of magicians in Western culture, the image of Merlin is the most easily recognized, as sort of an icon of magic. Merlin, the magician for King Arthur. The Harry Potter books are so popular now, but a few years back there was a lot of interest in Arthurian stories and Merlin, and there were lots of novels about Avalon. And the people I knew 10 years ago were reading these kinds of things the way today we're reading Harry Potter. It's another sign that we're fascinated with magic and magicians. I'll tell you two stories about Merlin, of the many. Just a gesture to the quest for the historical Merlin. There were magical figures in British history. In the 5th century, there was Merlin Ambrosius in Wales, who was a kind of tribal leader. In the 6th century, there was Merlin Silvestris, of Merlin of the Woods, who was a kind of hermit figure that people went to for advice and healing and such. And in the 12th century, when the Merlin stories were really written down, probably there were elements of both of these historical Merlins put into the final story. It's clear that the first story, or it's clear to me, being somewhat skeptical about these kinds of things, that the first story probably isn't true. The birth of Merlin took place when a devil seduced or impregnated a virgin. The devils wanted to incarnate. They thought it wasn't fair that the Christians had an incarnation. The satanic powers should also have an incarnation and should be born of a virgin. And so one of the devils impregnated a virgin. She realized what had happened, and she went to the priest and confessed. She didn't try to deny what had happened, and therefore the evil side of Merlin was able to be kept in check. It's a little bit like knowing what your complexes are and being able to work around them. So that's the story of the birth of Merlin. Merlin's last days were spent in the forest after he went to he went out of the court of Arthur, and before he had done this, he had taught one of his Nymion, the Lady of the Lake, the secret of his magic, and she was able to enchant him and keep him prisoner in the woods. I think that's a very powerful story. I'm sure that many important people in the world, including, no doubt, C.G. Jung, have been enchanted, have been entranced, have been entrapped by anima figures in their lives. And it shows that being a great magician is no defense against that. We'll go on briefly, in the interest of time, to the next magician, Harry Houdini. Again, most of us recognize the figure of Houdini. The man no chains could hold, the handcuff king, the person who could escape from all bonds, who claimed he could even escape from death and would come back, but he somehow didn't succeed in doing that. We probably, most of us, don't realize that when Houdini started out, he was a traditional sleight-of-hand performer who did children's birthday parties and produced silk handkerchiefs and doves and things. He was a complete flop. No one paid any attention to a Houdini who did birthday party magic tricks. It was only when Houdini became fascinated with the spiritualists and the way that spiritualist seances could take place even when the medium was being held or tied up, And when he wanted to debunk spiritualism in America around the turn of the century, that he discovered that he could, because of his skill and because of his physical prowess, he could escape from all sorts of things. And so he became the Houdini we think of today. One thing that I hadn't realized till I was doing this research is what, sometimes when he would escape in a theater show, it would take him up to an hour to escape from his handcuffs and chains. The audience would sit and wait patiently. They wouldn't walk out, they wouldn't boo and hiss, they would wait, and once he appeared free of his chains, they would cheer. One of the writers says, "When Houdini got free, we all got free." I think that's a very powerful kind of archetypal image. When Houdini got free, we all got free. We all long to be free of the chains that hold us down, and Houdini represents that for us. I said Houdini started out as a birthday party magician and transformed himself into the person that is famous. I want to show you. I thought it was next, but I'm gonna go until I find it, and I'll back up. I want to show you another kind of transformation. When I was in Georgia week before last, I came across this CD jacket in the CD store. How many of you know who this is? Yeah. Willie Nelson. That came to mind when you were talking about transformation. That's the Willie Nelson is the young magician without the beard, and not the one we're more familiar with. And I'll tell you what, I have a theory about Willie Nelson. I don't think it was just smoking pot. You know, I think that somehow the reason you sometimes see bumper stickers, Willie Nelson for president and things like that, is Willie Nelson for some of us suggests that here's somebody who has found his path in life, and he's not just going through the motions and trying to be a good boy like a lot of us. So Houdini was also in this camp. Yeah. Now I will back up one more. Magic words I said I wanted to talk about briefly. The two most famous are abracadabra and hocus pocus. Abracadabra is an ancient term, probably has to do with the mythological god figure Abraxas. Is often written in the form of an amulet or charm for healing in the triangular form that you see there. And one of the historians of magic says it comes from abracadabra, which means I create as I speak. And that rings true for me because in the Genesis story, God says, "Let there be light," and there is light. And somehow that is a magical kind of thing. I create as I speak. The other famous magic word is hocus pocus, which almost all authorities agree comes from hoc est corpus. Hoc est corpus mei. This is my body, or this is the body of Christ. Because the Latin Mass was very widespread in Europe. And in those days, the Mass was celebrated with the priests back to the congregation and sometimes mumbled. And the people knew that some kind of transformation was taking place, and all they could hear was something that sounded like hocus pocus, hocus corpus. I'm going to read you a quote from Robert Neal, who's a friend of mine, another kind of one of my heroes. I don't have too many heroes, but Robert Neal is one of them. He was professor of psychiatry and religion at Union Theological Seminary for 25 years, and then he quit to go on the road as a magician. In doing so, he's written a number of books now. One is called Magic and Meaning, and I'll read you part of what he says about magic words in Magic and Meaning. I'll summarize the first part. He says, "When my daughter was young, she would sometimes have colic, and she would cry in the middle of the night. I would get out of bed, I would pick her up, I would pace back and forth with my daughter in my arms, I would rock her, and I would say, 'It's all right, it's all right.'" He says, "It wasn't all right. I was tired and exhausted, and she was screaming, and nothing was all right. But nevertheless, I said these words, 'It was all right, it's all right,' And somehow, eventually, it was. Then he goes on. Many years later, I spent 6 months working in a hospice, caring for those who were dying. They did die, and they died. They did so often while I was in their company, sitting beside them, holding their hands or resting my hand on their shoulders. As I sat for hours and watched them die, it became clear that, you guessed it, everything was all right. How could this be? It was not all right. The person might be young with a family and career. The person might be older and have serious issues about their lives that were not resolved. And I was not all right myself with my life and family and work. Even so, I said, everything is all right, and it was so. At the end, as well as at the beginning of life, such primary magic words are commonplace. In analysis, I've said that there are aspects of analysis that are like magic, and I'd like to give you one or two examples as we start to conclude this. When I was first in analysis, it was in response to a divorce. Most people don't go into analysis just for the fun of it. You know, it's usually there's some kind of an issue or a crisis. In my case, it was divorce. I had my children on weekends, or maybe every other weekend. I also thought that my ex-wife was carefully judging how I was doing with the children. And, you know, it was the typical kind of situation. One day I had put the three children in the car. They were ages, I think, 9, 7, and 4. Or maybe it was 10, 8, and 5, something like that. They were quite young. And as I had put them in my car, I realized that I had forgotten the grocery list or whatever it was. And I ran quickly back into my apartment to get something. As I came out the apartment door, I noticed, to my horror, that my older daughter, had released the parking brake, and the car was starting to roll backwards down a hill. It's one of the two or three most horrible moments of my life, because no matter how fast I ran after the car, I couldn't catch it, couldn't stop it, and after rolling about a block, it ran into a tree, and the children weren't hurt, but the car was badly damaged, and my poor heart was just, when I talk about it, my heart starts to thump. I went to analysis, and I told my analyst the story. The damaged car, the children fortunately weren't hurt, but I was still horrified. And what my analyst said was, thank God the children weren't hurt. And suddenly the situation was transformed for me because the figure ground shifted, and the damaged car and my foolishness and such became secondary to the fact that the children weren't hurt, and that those were magic words for me. Mm-hmm. I'll mention one other kind of magic word to show you something about my journey. I was in analysis for many years with Mario Jacobi, and in those days I was rather inhibited about doing things that I wanted to do. For example, it took me a long time to get the address of the Jung Institute, and even longer to decide to go there and study. And, you know, I was always having ideas, but I was not willing to act on them because I thought they were silly or something. And Mario used to always say after these ideas, because none of them, fortunately, were, I think I'll go out and be an axe murderer or something like that. I would tell him one of my fantasies, and he would say, and why not? And why not? It's an honest, it's a deep, it's a way of finding your path, something like Willie Nelson or Houdini, or whatever. And so when I was graduating, I said to Mario, you know, one of the things that helped me most would be when you said, and why not? And so I saw him then after that, and he said, you know, I've been thinking about that that thing you said about how I helped you by saying why not? And I said, no, that's not what does it. You have to say, and why not? It has to be exactly like that, and you have to hold your head just so, and you say, and why not? And that frees me, that liberated me. I'll conclude by telling you one last story, and then we'll take a break and have some questions. When I first went to Zurich to explore the possibility of studying there, I was teaching philosophy, and one of the philosophers who I admired the most was Ludwig Binswanger, who was involved with existentialism, and Maynard Boss and Rollo May and that kind of thing, was one of the founders of the movement called existential analysis. His daughter, Hilda Binswanger, was a training analyst at the Institute, and so I went to have an hour with Hilda Binswanger. I said, I'm thinking about studying here, but I'm already a tenured full professor at a state university, and I have a good life, and I like it, and everyone would think it was really foolish for me to give that up and come to be a student again. And yet I have the urge. I have the feeling that somehow it's almost as though I'm being called, but that's silly. I don't believe in things like that. In any case, I know that it would be difficult, and I don't know. And it seems so, and it's in Europe, and I had all these excuses. And she said, Jung used to say, follow your snake, and the snake never goes straight ahead. The snake always goes in a serpentine path. Follow your snake, or in German, follow your Schlange. I didn't think at the time that the Yiddish comes into play here. Won't elaborate on that. The snake goes in a serpentine path, and she said, you're talking about being comfortable in your academic career, and that's straight ahead, and that's not how snakes go. And you can choose. You can follow that path and just continue the way you're going. And I decided I would risk going to Zurich, and then I graduated and went back to the United States and had a practice and was invited to come back to Zurich and be the director of studies, and I decided that maybe that was my path to go back again. I don't know where the future goes. But in any case, during my entire studies, I kept asking people, people who knew Jung, did Jung ever say to you, follow your snake? And they all said, no, no. And I kept looking in the collected works and the letters and things to see if Jung said, follow your snake. And then suddenly it dawned on me, maybe Hilda Binswanger was a trickster. And she just made this up because she thought it would get me out of my rut. But then as I was finishing my thesis, I decided to look one more time at the general index to the collected works. And I looked under wand, comma, magic. And it said, see caduceus. And I looked under caduceus, and it said, the right way to wholeness is made up of many fateful turnings and many wrong turnings and fateful detours. It is a serpentine path, not lacking in terrors. And I ended my thesis with this quote and the words, or in rewards. So it has been for me a long winding path. I hope it's been in the right direction. For me, it's been magical, and the images of magicians, historical or mythological, have been powerful for me. And I thank you for your attention. We'll take a little break and come back and talk about this. Thanks. The floor is open for questions or comments of any sort, and let's see what develops now in the next 20 or 30 minutes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. She mentions Hermann Hesse's novel, Magus der Lüdi, or The Glass Bead Game, as also being connected with this. I guess Magus der, in that sense, is just master, or something of the play, or I'm not sure what the origin of that is, but the German for master's degree is Magistergrad, and I assume it's connected with with mastery. Of course, magic is connected also with mastery and power and such. Yeah. There are many things. The magi, another synchronicity was when I finished the thesis, I decided to write a preface or acknowledgments the way people do sometimes, and it's common to date those things, put the place and date, and I put Zurich, Switzerland, January 6, 1996, and then I realized it was the day of the three kings or the three magi, just by coincidence. Yeah. Another question or comment? Yes. Yes. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Or two. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks. Yes. These are stories. And. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks. We don't know whether there really were three. Three is a nice number. Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. Somehow the three kings and the Trinity are bookends, or as what's the word for similar? Symmetrical. Mm-hmm. What else? Oh, yes, turn it off now. Yeah, I left it on at first so the bulb would cool off. Thanks. Someone in the back. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, in Native American trickster stories, there is the way of the snake and following the snake. That's right. And it's possible that these stories influenced Jung. He was quite interested, as you know, in Native American material. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that, though, but the way of the snake in the trickster stories. Yes. Yes, that's right. Coyote and his penis had an intimate relationship, and his penis had a divinatory aspect, let's say. Yes. This is interesting because, again, when I was visiting Peter Elting last week in San Francisco, I met a number of Peter's friends who were interesting, and we had a long discussion, one of them, about the coyote stories. And the next day, through the mail slot in Peter's front door, were six books of coyote stories. You know, please take these books to Zurich and read them. And so I'm going to do that. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yes, the white snake fairy tale is about individuation. Yeah, thank you. Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yes, I hadn't... I know the fairy tale, the white snake, and I hadn't made the connection. So that's another example. That's what I'm hoping for in the workshop tomorrow, that we'll have some connections. I have some material to bring, but I'm hoping that there'll be a lot of learning for me, too. Yeah. Yes, uh-huh. There are many females who are associated with these things. For some reason, there haven't been many females until just the last few years who performed on the stage as magicians, as entertainers. There are a few now, like Melinda in Las Vegas, and there are a few women conjurers or sleight-of-hand artists. But women have always been involved with certain aspects of magic, especially with divination. Fortune-telling, telling the future, you know, being in the old-fashioned terminology, witches, and having power, having magical power. One of the books that I studied or looked at for my thesis said that the majority of magicians in history have been women. Yes, Aphrodite is a kind of magician. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And it was mentioned in the back, giving birth is a kind of magic. All kinds of transformation is magic. I mentioned cooking because that's something I'm interested in. But, yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, men often, the comment was men often experience magic in relation to the women in their lives. For example, Samson and Delilah, And when Delilah cut Samson's hair, his power was gone. Or there are many other figures in mythology and stories where a woman has great power to wield over a man, not just Vivian and Merlin. In Houdini's case, I didn't mention this, but there were a number of women who had power over Houdini, his mother in particular. And while his mother was alive, they had contact in some fashion every day, and he said if his mother were ever to die, he would not be able to stand it. He was extremely depressed after she died, and he would go daily to the cemetery in New York and prostrate himself on her grave and weep. Whenever he was near his mother's grave, he went to visit his mother, and he never overcame that kind of mother attachment. So for the man who no chains could hold was somehow captivated by his mother. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that would be worth a lecture. Hacker culture in as magic, mm-hmm. Transforming and deceiving and dissembling and. Yes. Mm-hmm, yeah. Well, one thing, the people who perform on stage as magicians, which is something I've done all my life, are typically very decent people, but they like lying and cheating and getting away with it. It's a harmless kind of thing for entertainment purposes only, they say. But it involves a lot of cheating and lying and deceiving, and that feels good. Yeah, I usually get away with it. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Well, what I think is it's like the Zen ox herding pictures. If those of you who know those pictures in Zen will understand the reference, I think. But just to put it in ordinary terms, it's better not to be fooled. It's better to know reality, to have your feet on the ground, not to engage in magical thinking. It really is. And yet, once you see that a mountain is a mountain and a river is a river and that's just a woman or a man and a computer is just a tool, once you see that, then you're ready to be enchanted again at a different level. That's what I think. So I think to lose it completely, I think life would be very boring if we had no illusions or no hopes or no fantasies. But I think that, you know, I think that with something we work through and then we come out at the other side, so to speak, and we find magic all over again. I thought, as I said at the beginning, I thought my father really could produce quarters out of my ear. I thought that for the longest time. You know, like believing in the Easter Bunny or the Tooth Fairy or something like that. And then I found out that that wasn't so. And then I found out that there really is love and magic and wonder in the world in a different way than I thought at first. So, you know, I don't think it's good just to be totally without illusions or fantasies or something. We get them in a different way and in a way that aren't harmful. Uh-huh. Well, there are a lot of gains. One is the feeling of power. And that's not bad. Power's not bad. Or the enjoyment of power. Martin Luther King used to say, Martin Luther King used to say, we all want to be a drum major out leading the parade. You're showing them reality at a different level. You're expanding their ideas about what's possible. And they say, wow. And in the case of conjuring shows and that type of thing, most people I've discovered, well, I'm not going to reveal in the workshop, I'm not going to reveal anything that's going to ruin people's lives. You know, it's not going to be like that. It's going to be showing some of the principles involved, like misdirection, the use of the wand, I didn't talk about that, the way of planning ahead and a way of thinking outside the box, as people say these days. But in the service of something. So for me, to have power, to be a drum major, To be an entertainer, Martin Luther King said, I'd like to be a drum major for justice and for peace, and not a drum major for my own personal thing. But, and I would like to entertain people so that they have the feeling of, wow, gosh, you know, that was neat, or something. It's a way of going back and becoming like children again when it works. That's what it is. Children know magic. And if we, insofar as we can come closer to that early experience of childlike wonder, that's good, I think. Yes? Well, the child archetype is very closely connected to all of this because children naturally have that sense of magic and wonder. Part of it is because they don't know all the facts about the world. But they have a natural playful delight, and that's good not to lose. And if you lose it temporarily, it's good to come back to it, as I did in the case of my father. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like the Eliot poem, we shall not seek from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. So we don't get to a different place, but we get to that same place, but we know it in a new way, or we appreciate it in a new way. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.